My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Noise, the podcast series from PR Week. I'm John Harrington, the editor of PR Week UK and your host today. I'm joined by PR Week editor-in-chief Danny Rogers and news editor Siobhan Holt. Hi to you both.
Hi, John.
Hello.
Now, if you visited prweek.com during March, you probably noticed that our 2024 UK PowerBook is live. For those who don't know, the PowerBook is PR Week's annual directory of the most influential people in UK comms. Everyone in the book has completed a short Q&A about their views of various industry topics and of themselves. We'll be discussing what they've been saying today and hopefully answering your burning questions about the project, including some insights into how we choose who gets in. But before we start, I'd like to give a plug for some upcoming PR Week events. Influencer 360, first off, which examines the latest trends in influencer marketing, takes place in London on 10th of April. And PR 360, PR Week's biggest conference of the year, is happening in Brighton on the 8th and 9th of May. Check out the events section of the PR Week website for more information and to book. Okay, so firstly, Danny, the PowerBook has been going for several years, and as the longest serving PR Week journalist on this episode, what can you tell us about the background to the project, I suppose, and how it's evolved over the years?
Yeah, well, the PowerBook was actually launched in 2007. Makes me feel very old. Yeah, we launched it because Campaign, our sister title, had just launched the A-List, which is their directory of everybody who works in advertising and marketing and so on. And we thought, well, the PR industry is a pretty big industry now, and there's hundreds of very influential professionals in it. It'd be nice to have a directory of them with contact details and to rank them and so on. So, we launched it, I guess. There must have been around a couple of hundred people in the original PowerBook back then. There's now more like, what is it, 450, 500 people in the PowerBook today?
Yeah.
And one of the big changes is that we used to do an overall ranking of the top 10 most powerful people in PR overall. And that became increasingly difficult. And now, of course, we do top 10s in, what is it, about 30 or?
Oh, I think it might be 34 in the end of this year.
Yeah. It's grown this year.
30 plus really grown. Categories of top 10. Yeah. But that's really helped us because by breaking it down into all the different top 10s, you ensure that we have enough comms professionals from media, or from sport or from politics and so on. So it's become much more structured and it's become very comprehensive. And I think it just shows what a grown up and talented industry it is now that you can do this very structured directory of so many people.
When I first started here, sort of almost 10 years ago, we discussed sort of top 10s overall and so on. And it was difficult because a lot of the time, frankly, it's the same people. You know, it's the people running the big agencies. They don't change that often, you know, the really senior people. And then in-house maybe change slightly more, arguably. But it's also very hard to rank them, isn't it?
It's extremely difficult. And one of the big changes, as you say, is that it used to be very agency-dominated. Now, I'd say it's about half and half. which the industry is probably about half and half. So far more client-side people in it. And we've got client-side people from so many different sectors, and that's a real improvement on the book.
Definitely. It was good to see so many of them at the awards launch as well, because, you know, overall, we probably hear a bit less from clients than we do from agencies, but it's really great to hear how engaged they are in everything going on in the sector. And that was really good. So going into some of the answers, I guess, to the Q&As and some of the overall trends, I wrote a piece a few weeks ago looking at the answer to the question, what do you plan to do less of in 2024? And the piece I wrote had the headline, Power Book Elite Want Less Talk, More Action. I really got a sense that too much time in this industry is taken up by kind of pontificating, spending time in meetings, answering sort of numerous emails and other messages, and maybe not enough time on the main tasks of kind of helping clients and employers solving their problems. And I really got a sense as well that Power Book members crave a kind of better work-life balance. What do you think about this? Is this something that you've sort of heard anecdotally about the sector, that there are just too many distractions these days, that it's hard to focus, and people also do want that sort of work-life balance to be a bit better?
And I'd agree. Even when we do our PR Room 101, that does seem to be a topic that crops up a lot. It's more things like booking a meeting to have a meeting about a meeting, and like the pre-meeting before the meeting. Yeah. I think a lot of people are getting a bit tired of, you know, just come up and ask me a question if you've got a question. I suppose we can also be a bit susceptible to that as well as a business. But yeah, I can completely understand why some PR pros are just a bit tired of the endless questions and the endless meetings about meetings.
Yeah,
it sounds a bit like our own lives sometimes, doesn't it?
It does.
I guess 'twas always thus to a certain extent, that working life is so often about endless meetings and sort of administration, when all you really want to be doing is your core job, which is advising clients for PR people, or dealing with the media, or in our case, writing stories and collecting information. And too often you're distracted by the other stuff.
True, true. Moving on, this is a really interesting area, I think, of the Power Book, which we ask sort of every year, really. We ask about the people and the organisations they think have handled comms the most adeptly and also the most poorly in the past 12 months. I thought I'd give a bit of a rundown of the bottom five and then the top five, and we can maybe have a bit of a discussion about what stood out for us all. So I'm going to start with the bottom five, so the worst for handling comms. At number five, we had Prince Harry / Harry and Meghan. Number four was the Post Office. Number three, Michelle Moan, including Douglas Barrowman, her husband. Second was the UK government / Tory party / Prime Minister. And number one was Elon Musk. Lots to say about this. I guess, are you both sort of surprised at who's there and the order they're in?
I think it was a surprise that Elon Musk came top of the most dishonourable mentions. Yeah, I mean, Elon Musk is an interesting character in that, I mean, if you go back about 5 or 10 years, he was seen as a marketing genius, this guy. I mean, he was putting cars into space to launch Tesla, that Tesla model. He was, most admired business person for the way he'd built Tesla up, and SpaceX to a certain extent. And he used some amazing communications and creative marketing to build those brands. But since he's been at Twitter, it seems to be perceived as a complete disaster. And it's certainly a big turnaround. I'm not sure if it's a communications problem with Elon Musk. I don't know what you guys think.
There are just a lot of fundamental problems at Twitter, aren't there, or X? I do think the sort of branding of that was just been bizarre. And I think what he was saying about advertisers, you know, he kind of swore, didn't he? He dropped the F-bomb when, you know, someone was interviewing him about what he thinks of advertisers that are leaving the platform, which is so strange. I also think that part of the reason he's there is probably due to the timing of when the questionnaire goes out, because I think we all have a sort of recency bias. I mean, we're probably all thinking at the moment that the worst comms handling of the year is going to be the royal family.
Weeks ago, we might have said the Post Office.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that might be linked to this. Plus, this is an industry where social media sites are something that we're focused on a lot, right?
Mm.
Whereas we're probably less focused on, you know, what's going on with the Royals or, you know, the Post Office or someone. It's kind of part of our everyday that we deal with social media. So maybe that's an element to this.
Yeah, there's a feeling that Elon Musk has ruined Twitter, although I'm not sure Twitter ever made money, did it? So
no.
And I guess if you bought a medium like Twitter at huge cost and you're Elon Musk, your main objective is to make money out of it in some way. He's an entrepreneur.
It strikes me as one of these things where, you know, he bought it to influence the conversation, didn't he? I mean, it's like you see the kind of, you know, the rise of a lot of the sort of right wing radio channels and TV channels. it's kind of not there. It's a means to an end. It's not an end in itself.
Yeah.
It's about controlling the conversation and influencing what's happening, influencing politics and society and so on. And
in that sense, he's failed then, really. If the reason that he bought Twitter was to influence society and make himself look better, I think he probably has failed.
Yeah, then the comms failure's right there, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Looking at some of the others, I mean, I think we probably don't need to say much about the government, do we?
People always hate the government, don't they? I mean, whoever the government is, they're always seen as the worst communicators by the PR profession. So people just don't like governments.
They don't. It'll be interesting to see if we do have a new government next time, how they come up on this.
No, they'll hate them.
History shows.
Yeah. Michelle Moan, we've spoken about a lot, haven't we?
We have. We've had a moan about Moan.
We've had a moan about Moan. And a dig at Douglas Barryman. Thank you. So it feels like that's a solid sort of comms crisis, if ever there's been one. The sort of the handling of that has been pretty spectacularly bad. And the post office, obviously.
Yeah, it's a strange one. Again, I'm not sure that's a communications issue. That's just terrible practice, isn't it? The post office. I mean, yeah, the stuff they've done to sub postmasters is scandalous, and I'm not sure you can communicate your way out of that one.
No, and it's funny, isn't it? That Harry and Meghan are in this, whereas you know, if you sent out the questionnaire now, I doubt they'd feature too highly in this list, given the focus on relatives.
Yeah, I just wonder with Prince Harry. I mean, I know everybody says he's a terrible communicator, but it depends what he was trying to achieve. I mean, his book was an absolute bestseller, right?
Mm-hmm.
He must have made loads and loads of money out of writing that book. Was his objective ever to be seen as part of the royal family again? I'm not sure it was. I think he'd probably had enough of it. So I wonder if he's a bad communicator or just people just don't like him.
Yeah, I'd agree, especially following the documentary as well, the interview that they did. That's the same sort of argument again, that it's whether you actually watched it and liked them afterwards rather than necessarily whether he communicated. I mean, obviously there were some challenges over what he said and what they included in it, but yeah, I think that falls in the same category. Is it that people just don't like them?
Yeah, and I think he's always been seen as a good communicator historically, Harry, much more so than William, actually. Mm. And all the stuff he did for the Armed Forces charity.
Yep.
The Invictus Games.
Yes.
Invictus, yeah. He was massively praised for that. What a brilliant communicator he was. And, you know, when he took on a cause, he saw it through. So, yeah, I'm not sure how much of his is a criticism of his comms ability and how much is just not liking him.
He's also very keen to take on the big publications, you know, the sort of the legal cases he's been having there. So, you know, it's very much sort of two fingers to the sort of kind of UK media establishment.
Definitely.
But that is what he wants to do. I think in a way, it depends what happens now. He needs to sort of establish his next course. And if he does that from this background, then, you know, he may well prove to be a good strategy.
Mm.
But if I think the problem is he probably looks like he's been sort of whining a bit and not necessarily producing enough for people. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
feel like he's got to sort of have the next stage sorted. But yeah, interesting one. Okay, we're going to take a break now for some messages. Do stay around for more insights on the Power Book and some information about how we choose who is included.
Listen to the Wind Power Podcast to hear discussions probing some of the topics and issues which are shaping the wind industry, as well as one-to-one interviews with some of its most senior figures, and a monthly news review which features our regular panel of analysts and experts. Wind Power is hosted by Wind Power Monthly's editorial team and is available wherever you download your podcasts.
Okay, let's look at those who've impressed the most for their comms then. So, number 5, Marks and Spencer. Number 4, Barbie/Mattel/Margot Robbie. Number 3 was the Beckhams. Number 2, King Charles/the Monarchy/the Royals. You might have something to say about this. And number 1, of course, Taylor Swift.
Swifties.
So, who wants to start? Anyone want to talk about... I mean, none of these people are in the news anymore, so there's not a lot to say.
I don't
really feel
qualified to talk about Taylor Swift particularly, or even Barbie, so...
Yeah.
Shall I talk a bit about Marks and Spencer, maybe? Because I think they were one of our most admired companies of 2023, PR Weeks, the way they've turned around their business. Is it a communications job? Of course, that's part of it. It's just become a much better run business, I think, over the past few years. They've sorted out their clothing operation, And suddenly Middle England seems to want to go back to M&S, whereas previously they'd sort of shunned it for many years. So I think that's a good choice in as a top five comms performer.
I agree. And I do think that in hindsight, that situation where they had, you know, the sort of the Christmas campaign image and the sort of some people relating it to sort of images from Palestine, Gaza and so on. I do think they handled that quite deftly, actually. I think some people were saying they went over the top by apologising and taking it down. But actually, I think that sense of this could be really serious, let's nip it in the bud. I think in hindsight, they did that well. So, yeah, I agree. It's the sort of brand building side, but also the crisis side. I think there's a lot to be said for them.
Absolutely. And I think as well, they've had a lot more, their CEO and top leadership have been more vocal on things like LinkedIn over the last 12 months. And as we've written about plenty of times that CEOs do, if they speak out, there is, you know, on really sort of promoting what the work they've been doing, but also challenging some of the decisions, for example, over the their new store in London. Yeah. I think that sort of presence people do appreciate or do listen to. So yeah. I think that's another factor in it as well.
Definitely, definitely. Before we go to the sort of the official royal, should we go for the sort of the nation's unofficial royal? So the Beckhams.
Yeah, the Beckhams is a brand that I do have view on because I used David Beckham in the book I wrote 9 years ago as an example of great campaigning. He's always been a brilliant campaigner. He's very good at managing his own image, and I think Victoria is as well. And they've always done lots of great collaborative work with different brands. I think the Netflix series was a overwhelming success. Very clever, because a lot of people thought that that was a documentary about them without realizing that I think the producer actually worked for them. So it's a sort of, it is a PR job, the Beckhams. It's the portrayal of their lives that they would have wanted, as opposed to
curated,
a fly on the wall, classic fly on the wall. And I think it's probably done them a lot of good.
And especially when you contrast with that, the documentary of Harry and Meghan, which was out in a similar year, it's a very stark contrast when you look at that listing and where they've ranked and the response that's been received.
I was going to say as well, you could almost sort of have a comparison with or a contrast with the Moans. And do you remember they put out this really long documentary on YouTube that was about an hour where hardly anyone saw it, because why would anyone see that?
But
it was basically the same sort of the same kind of principle, really, because I think the Beckhams did have a bit of a PR job to do, because they're, you know, David being criticised for Qatar, his involvement in Qatar, like the back end particularly of 2022. I do think that there was a bit of work to do. So it's interesting that, you know, they went down this route. And yeah, I agree.
And then of course he famously queued up, didn't he
did.
For the
yes,
for the Queen's funeral, and that won him lots of friends.
Yes, yeah. But it shows, doesn't it, how quickly your reputation can go from one extreme to the other very fast.
Well, talking of which, let's look at number two, King Charles, the monarchy, the royal household. I guess at the time when people filled this in, it was obviously long before Kate Gate or Photogate or whatever we're calling it. And I think there genuinely was this sense that King Charles is doing, you know, pretty well at his comms, that there weren't a lot of mistakes, particularly in the last 12 months, excluding the last few weeks.
I think it was a lot of success based off the coronation from the comments that were written from the PR pros. It was very mixed on who they were sort of compliment. Charles was quite often referenced, but sometimes Camilla would be referenced as well, or the royals generally, or the household, or the PR team. But then also, I think as well, his appearance at COP as well, I think also was credited as another reason for his demonstration of his communication skills and his commitment to sustainable initiatives. And
yeah, that we all know has been a big, you know, passion of his for a long time.
For a very long time, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and then, you know, elephant in the room, what's been happening in the last sort of, you know, week and a bit. The contrast, I mean, you know, it feels like we could go down this route and talk about this for a whole episode, but...
Well, it's the whole never explain, never complain dilemma, isn't it, for the royal household. You know, they are, I suppose, an anachronistic institution, and the more they talk about real life and their everyday problems, the more they lose their mystique for people, and they rely very much on mystique being a royal family. And I think the Kate Middleton photo was a classic example of that.
Yeah. It's a real balance between trying to be relatable and keep that mystique, isn't it? That's something the royal family have just always battled.
Yeah.
And they've done some interesting documentaries over the years where they've tried to peek behind the curtain, and it's worked, and then it really hasn't in some cases.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's a very challenging time, but I think King Charles still is remaining quite consistent on his comms, though, because he still had quite a lot of praise over the recent diagnosis and the handling of that, and sort of
although
the raising awareness.
We still don't know what type of cancer he's got.
No, we don't.
Which is strange, I guess.
Yeah.
That you say you've got cancer, but you don't tell
actually
people
stipulate
what it is.
Which one. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like the problem at the moment is there's the vacuum, isn't there?
Mm.
You know, and the conspiracy is I was on Twitter X earlier on, and you know, probably 4 out of 5 tweets related to Kate.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's just because that's the nature of the PR Week Twitter account, but it's extraordinary.
So much of that's conspiracy nonsense, though. That's the trouble.
It really is.
An educated viewpoint on anything. It's just, bizarre claims a lot of the time.
Very bizarre.
Anyway, we haven't even mentioned Taylor yet.
I haven't mentioned Taylor Swift. I mean, she can't put her foot wrong, can she?
No, she can't. And when she does, people come to her defence in a lot of ways, don't they? They really...
The sort of fandom. I think she's the best example of the kind of, the sort of the advocacy comms, really. You know, people talk about internal comms and having like your own advocates. But if you've got that sort of support base, you know, it's great. And I also think, you know, when I have seen her criticised, there's things like her taking a private jet and stuff like that. And you can argue that, you know, some people get really criticised for that sort of thing.
Mm.
But she doesn't. And I think that's partly because people know that you're just going to get weighed in on, and everyone, you're going to get all of these, like, this army basically attacking you.
Yep.
And, you know, maybe having a sequined army is the way to deter detractors.
Shake it off.
There we go.
Had to get it in.
Well done. That's probably the only song of hers that I know, to be honest. But to be fair, it's good. Okay, so I'm going to move on. Top campaign. So we asked the PowerBook elite to name their favourite creative campaigns from the past year. And some of these, I'm not sure they quite count as creative, but nevertheless. So number 5, and apologies to any French speakers, but I'm going to try to pronounce this.
Go on, John.
So it's campaign for Orange, La Compile des Bleus. Number 4 was the post office scandal, the justice campaign for the scandal, I should say. Third was Specsavers, the Misheard version, which is the Rick Astley campaign involving misheard lyrics. Second was Norwich FC, checking on those around you, and the sort of video that went viral on that. And number 1 was the launch of the Barbie movie, and we're combining that with Barbenheimer and the sort of phenomenon of Oppenheimer and Barbie sort of being released at the same time. So, who would like to come in on these?
I would like to just say a few things, I think, about Norwich FC, which I think personally, on reflection, it was one of the greatest campaigns of last year. And I think one of the reasons it was because it was done on such a low budget. You know, you've got the top two, Barbie and Norwich. You couldn't get more different in terms of budget.
Probably not.
You know, Barbie, where you've got the might of Warner Brothers and Mattel and countless other brands, marketing spend chucked at it. Norwich FC, which is currently a championship club. I mean, big-ish club, but not the biggest. And it runs a campaign for World Mental Health Day in conjunction with the Samaritans, which is very important, I think, because it was very well, you know, very well written and well briefed. And it's a really nice little film. And if people haven't seen that film, I suggest they look at it on YouTube. It's an incredibly powerful bit of storytelling, I think. And it's
really
got that
is.
Twist.
Yeah. And it's so understated, isn't it? You know, it's so understated. From that way, it couldn't be less like Barbie, that is basically a world of pink, and then Oppenheimer, which is a nuclear bomb. So literally, it's as far away as that. Yeah, I agree. I think it was absolutely brilliant.
And it just really picked up so much on social media. Like, it just really rolled, didn't it? And the attention it got from that, as you say, it was just phenomenal, really.
Exactly. And so it was endorsed by the Samaritans originally, but then all the other mental health charities weighed in with their support for it once it had become a phenomenon. So it had that effect of being magnified by lots of mental health charities.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Really good, really good. Siobhan, any of the others?
The post office, although it's not necessarily a campaign in the same way as some of the others are, I predict this will be also in next year's PowerBook responses, because I think, obviously, it's still ongoing. So I think that's one of the reasons why it's going to be back again. But I think just the strength of it, really. And I think it's similar to the Norwich FC in the sense of it's really sort of caught the attention of people. And as a result, that's the power of it. I think a lot of people really resonate with sort of the injustice And from that, there's been a bit of a strength behind that. And that's why it's really really stuck with people. You know, they are just ordinary people that this has happened to. And obviously, we can't not say the ITV drama has done it a huge amount of favour.
Well, I was about to say that. I mean, this was a campaign, as I understand it, was going on for many years and not really cutting through until Mr. Bates First of the Post Office became a thing.
Yeah.
And that seemed to completely change the game when you create that really powerful bit of storytelling, human storytelling.
Yeah. I think this is a common theme between a lot of the points as well. You know, the power of a television show to accompany something with a campaign can really pick up. It does seem to be quite a common theme throughout, whether that's good or bad.
Yeah, filmic storytelling can be more powerful than anything, can't
it? Yeah, absolutely. What about you, John? What was one that resonated with you?
So I'm going to go for the misheard version, the Specsavers campaign. That was by Golin. I thought this was really good, just to give a bit of background. So Rick Astley re-recorded versions of songs where he was singing lyrics that people had misheard, basically. So there's that kind of humorous element to it, and the fact that, you know, a lot of people like Rick Astley and he's sort of charismatic and all the rest of it. But it also makes an important point about hearing loss.
Mm.
And this was to promote Specsavers hearing loss kind of service. And I think it's worth saying that as well as being creative, this did actually have a business impact because there was a sort of marked increase in number of people going to get their hearing tested at Specsavers. And it must be quite a comms job.
I was just going to say that must have been a real challenge when they were given that brief, because as you say, it's called Specsavers.
Yeah.
Yeah, and their advertising has always been about seeing things badly as opposed to hearing things badly.
Definitely, yeah. So I think, and you know, it was a good viral video. It was something that people actually enjoyed, but it had an interesting point. It had a sort of purpose angle to it, but at the same time, it had the sort of business results. So I think it kind of ticks a lot of those boxes in my mind. So yeah, I think that was a good one. Okay, moving on. Siobhan, there were some interesting findings on AI. We asked PowerBook members how prepared they think they're organisations are for AI. What were the PowerBook elite saying about it?
Yeah, so as you say, we asked the question from the members to rate how prepared they feel their organisation is for the AI era. Just 1 in 10 said they consider their organisation to be very prepared. We asked them to vote out of 5. So of the 232 that responded, 41% selected 3 out of 5, while 34% selected 4. So it would suggest that organisations feel moderately prepared for AI. However, we found that 11% gave a rating of 2. So there is some nervousness out there. And then just 4% scored 1. So it was quite an interesting mix. We had Simon Enright from Freud's came out with that only a fool would say they are fully prepared for AI, and that being curious and adaptable seems to be half the battle. And then Brendan Craigie from Taito said the infrastructure is still very immature and not fully scalable, which was very interesting. And there was a lot of terms like cautious, not going to replace the relationship in PR, that kept cropping up and up. But what I found was interesting was that Martin Curry from City Press said that AI's pace and scale makes it impossible for anyone to know how prepared they are. And he believes that the hype and hysteria will subside and we'll soon start seeing its true practical potential, which I thought was a good summary of it, because I do think we've experienced it, that some people seem to be very prepared for AI and have a lot of information on it, and some are still a bit sceptical on how they're using it. But two that did say they were using it were Helen Coop from 4 Agency and Alex Doria, energy company OVO. Both said they've been using AI across the business in different areas for a while. And Doria said, done well, AI should give you a better insight and more time, which I thought was a really good summary of it.
Yeah, I guess it can be a really useful tool done well.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of things you can use it for in terms of insight and creative production. And we shouldn't be afraid of it, I guess, if we understand it properly.
Definitely, definitely. And you look at the amount that the sort of agency world is spending on this.
Mm.
I mean, roughly $250 million a year WPP are spending. And obviously that goes way beyond the PR agencies, but it gives you an idea. And publicists similarly, and no doubt the others. So it's a big question mark, isn't it? You know, how it's going to affect the industry over the next year or two.
One of the big questions is, you know, if it does improve efficiency, does that cut jobs?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is almost certainly. And that's why it's a tricky conversation to have in businesses, because yes, it makes them more effective and efficient, but that may be at the expense of people.
Yeah, and there are some that have said they are training their staff now on it, so to face the future. But as you say, that future might be uncertainty for some of those staff members.
Yeah, and you see Unilever, to bring us up to date, Unilever today announcing 7,500 job cuts, a big marketing consumer brands company cutting jobs. And you wonder how much of that is in preparation for the AI age, just speculating, but it's here.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so finally, one question we get asked every year, understandably, is how do people get in the Power Book?
Or stay in the Power Book.
Or stay in the Power Book. I wrote an article on this last year, so I'm going to give a few sort of overall pointers. First thing to say is it's an editorial decision.
So you ended the argument there.
Yep, that's it. Done. You can stop listening now. No, don't stop listening. So there's no application process. It's not like the PR Week award schemes that we have where we'll get a panel of judges and we'll get sort of application forms and all of that. We don't do that. It doesn't really work for us and a project like this. It's entirely sort of editorial. I also say please don't lobby us, especially just before it goes live. And there's not much point doing it just after either. I do, however, want to point to a few things that can help people's case of being included. So these are things like, most obvious one, having a senior leadership role at a big and or fast growing agency or equivalent in-house, winning major awards, or kind of being a deep sector specialist or a genuine innovator or a prominent figure in important issues such as D&I and sustainability, that sort of thing. But there's no sort of hard and fast rule. Mm-hmm. These are sort of just guidelines. But yeah, I just thought I'd throw that out.
It's interesting, John, because we started this conversation by you asking me about the launch of the Power Book in 2007. I remember the same questions then. I mean, how much of it is the selection of the Power Book objective? How much of it is subjective? And of course, the answer is always both, because it's objective in the sense that we do try and to get representation from all the big companies and brands, the comms leaders and all those businesses. We look at the size of agencies. We look at the size of agencies in particular specialisms. So it is quite scientific in the sense of we want to make sure we get all the right people in from all the right organisations. But of course, it's editorial, so it's subjective. It's our judgment at the end of the day as to, you know, and it is the people as well. It's not just the organisation you work with. It's the contribution you make to the wider industry, your network, your influence generally in the sector. So, there's an element of subjectivity, of course.
Yeah, this is quite a kind of chalk and cheese as well, isn't it? Because, you know, there are different types of influence. You can be influential just by the fact that you're the boss of an agency with lots of people. Then your decisions influence what goes on. But you might have a very sort of low public profile.
Very true.
Or you could be someone who's basically a campaigner, who could be a sort of sole operator, but has really sort of shaken things up when it comes to big issues. So, you know, you can't really compare these two roles, but they're both influential in different ways. So that's one of the challenges we have every year.
And it helps to engage with us as well. So it's very difficult for us to judge if somebody's influential if they don't really talk to PR Week and tell us what they're up to, what work they've produced, the sort of stuff they've been doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So kind of get involved in what we do all year, I'd say, rather than sort of lobby 2 weeks before we go live is a much more preferable way of doing
and
it.
And fill out the form.
And fill out the form.
The amount of people we have that don't even fill out the form and then ask why they're not in the Power Book.
Fill out the form. And also maybe have a word with like your people who deal with your spam filters. Because I appreciate getting an email saying you've been selected to be in a list of the most influential. You're probably expecting just pay, you know, $10,000 to, you know, whoever.
You don't have to. It's free.
You don't have to. It's free. There's no. If you do get any emails asking for money, that is someone faking it.
Yeah, that's not us.
So, that's not us.
That's definitely
we'll buy
not
you
us.
A drink at the launch, but we won't.
That's it. So hopefully that helps for anyone who wants to ask questions on those sorts of things. But so that's it. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you to Danny and Siobhan for sharing your thoughts and insights. Before we go, I'd like to plug a few PR Week awards. 30 Under 30, firstly, our annual search for the young stars of UK PR is open for entries. The deadline is coming up. You can also enter the PR Week UK Awards. That's our biggest awards event of the year and a seminal moment in the industry's calendar. So don't miss out. And if you've enjoyed today's episode, we'd love it if you could leave a review, please, wherever you access PR Week's Beyond the Noise podcast. Preferably a five-star one. Yes, please. Okay, thank you for listening. Until next time, goodbye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamline my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.